So I decided to do a word ramble today. Now, what's a word ramble? Back in the early 80s, I think it was, on Morning Edition on NPR, yes, I did listen to it, there was a poet and philosopher by the name of John Chardy who would come on and he would do what he called a word ramble. He'd pick a word and talk about its etymology, talk about other words related to it and how all these things fit into culture and so on. And I thought this was kind of a neat idea, so I did it on a podcast on enchantment. Eric asked me to do it on sacrament. I'm going to do it on culture today. Okay, so culture. Because I was asked, what is culture? That, you know, that's the topic I was given for my 15 minutes of fame here. So what I did is I started, well, I know that there are a whole lot of words related to culture, but I wanted to make sure I got it right. So I started going back into the Latin. It turns out that the word culture originally comes from a word that means to cultivate. It's originally a verb from to cultivate, which means to tend, to cultivate, or to protect. Okay. Now, where this leads immediately in the Roman culture is to agriculture. It goes right to farming. Culture originally referred to what you did on a farm. We talk about agriculture, which comes from the Latin ager, meaning field, so cultivating fields. We can talk about viticulture, one of my favorites, cultivating vines, typically for wine. We can talk about horticulture, which is a really important one. It comes from the word hortus, which means garden, cultivating a garden. Keep that in mind. We'll come back to it. Now, culture also, so it points to this idea of taking what's there, clearing the weeds as needed, and producing things, growing things, making things come into existence that wouldn't have been there without our effort. Okay, so that's the core meaning. We can also look at culture in some other ways. What does it mean when we talk about a cultured person? A cultured person is someone who has cultivated himself with education, with the arts, with developing taste, those kinds of things. It's what we refer to as a cultured person. But it again, it comes back to this idea of cultivating, taking what's there and developing it further. Taking the raw material of your mind, your taste, your emotions, developing it and refining it. Culture also shows up though in some other places. An example you might think of, if probably not in this context, is yogurt. Yogurt has cultures in it. And what do these cultures do? The cultures take the raw material of the milk and develop it into something else. Actually, if you want to be more precise, what yogurt cultures do in milk is reproduce and multiply, fill the milk and subdue it. And that brings us to horticulture, cultivating the garden. The roots of culture, if I can actually use that phrase, the roots of culture go back all the way into Genesis 1 and 2. In Genesis 1, God says, "Let us make man in our image and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air," and so on. So God makes man in his own image. In his own image, he makes them male and female. He created he them. Okay, so human beings are made in the image of God. And what we're used to hearing here is the image of God is what gives people dignity. This is why all people have dignity. All people are equal in the sight of God because we're all made in God's image, men and women and so on. And that's absolutely true. But that's not what is fundamental to the idea of the image of God. The idea of the image of God, if you go back to the ancient Near East, the context in which Genesis was written, what you find is that a lot of pagan kings in the surrounding areas referred to themselves as the image of a god. Marduk, the principal god of Babylon, the king of Babylon would say, "I am the image of Marduk." Okay, what did that mean? What that meant to the king is that he was claiming divine authority to rule. What he was saying is, "Well, I'm Marduk's image. I am Marduk's face on earth." Marduk has given me authority to rule under him as his regent on the earth. This is culturally what that refers to throughout the ancient Near East. And what do you see in Genesis? Let us make man in our own image and let him have dominion. He's picking up on exactly the same language, the same idea that existed within the pagan world. The image of God is a job description. What the image of God is it's saying, you are going to be my rulers, my regents, my stewards. Think the stewards of the Lord of the Rings. You're going to be my stewards on the earth. Okay? That's why being made in God's image and having dominion are linked immediately, multiple times actually, in Genesis 1. Now, what does that mean? You know, what does stewardship look like? Well, I want to take you forward now to Genesis 2. Well, before we go there, I want you to note that the image of God, male and female, he created them. This points to two different things. First of all, men and women equally bear the image of God, but further, that the image of God is most complete when we have male and female together in a conjugal union. We see this in Genesis 2. Why is that? Well, if we're supposed to reproduce and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, if that's the description that God says, God tells man, reproduce, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. First of all, how are you going to reproduce and multiply? You need husband and wife. How are you going to fill the earth and subdue it? It turns out that that's way too big a job for just one person. You need the family to be the foundation for carrying out this role of dominion over the earth. You need the family. Why? Because you need helpers. You need other people to work. This is why the family is the fundamental unit of society. And it's why when you mess with the family, you are undermining the entire structure of society. Because in order to carry out the work that we've been given of dominion, and we'll look more detail of what that means later, you've got to begin with the family. Okay, so what is the job of dominion? Let's go to Genesis 2. It turns out, well, first of all, we need to remember that work in Scripture is not a necessary evil. It's a positive good. How do we know that? God himself worked. In 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth and all that's in them, and on the seventh day, he rested from all his labors. God's depicted as a laborer. If God is a worker, how can you call work a necessary evil? Work is a positive good. And human beings made in the image of God to carry out his, to live out his authority in the world are also workers. Now, what does this look like? Well, what does God tell Adam to do? First of all, you know, God creates Adam. He says it's not good for man to be alone. But before he creates Eve, he brings all the animals to Adam and tells him to name them. Now, this isn't naming them like Fluffy and Fido and things like that. Naming the animals is something that is really important for two reasons. The first of them is that the person who gives something a name has authority over it. This is Adam acting out his dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and everything else. By naming them, he is exercising dominion. But the second part of it is a little bit more interesting. In Hebrew, the idea is that your name should represent your nature. Your name shows what you are. This is why over and over again, when people have a meaningful encounter with God, their name is changed, because they become a different person, and therefore there is a different nature, and there must be a different name. Jacob becomes Israel, Abram becomes Abraham, and so on. So in order to name the animals, Adam had to understand what they were. It's the work, if you will, of taxonomy. He had to look at them, he had to study them, he had to understand their nature in order to give them their proper names. In other words, naming the animals is the beginning of science. That's part of creating culture. But then God places Adam in the garden, and he gives them the instructions, tend the garden and protect it. Tend and protect the garden. That's the next part of the job. Now, what does that mean? Well, it turns out that if you look at the description of the Garden of Eden, there are a couple of things that are notable about it. The first thing that you should notice is that the Garden of Eden is described first as a place of beauty. The trees were a delight to the eyes. We ignore that, but it's important. The second thing is that the trees also produce fruit that's good to eat. A third thing to notice is that the location of the garden is in a place that is full of all kinds of resources. You read the description, there's gold in Havila, you know, all of these kinds of things there. There's a boatload of resources there. And God tells Adam to tend and protect the garden. So tending the garden is going to be the work of, well, first of all, cultivating, there's that word again, cultivating beauty. Why? Because the first thing we hear about the garden is that it's a place of beauty. If we're going to tend the garden, we have to cultivate beauty. This is a mandate to do the arts. It's a place that provides food. This is a mandate for economic production. And all the other resources there, there's also a mandate to develop them. Why do I say that? Back to Genesis 1. When you look at Genesis 1, what you see is, in the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. That's the problem. Darkness is over the face of the deep, and so on. So what does God do with a world that's formless and void, formless and empty? Well, what do you have to do to fix that? You got to form it and fill it. Day one, day two, and day three, God is forming the world. He separates light from darkness. He separates the waters under the heavens from the waters above the heavens. He makes dry land. Day four, five, and six, he's filling it. Day one was light and darkness. Day four is sun, moon, and stars. Day two is, well, sky and sea. Day five is birds and fish. Day three is dry land. Day six is land animals, culminating in us. There's a correspondence, 1 to 4, 2 to 5, 3 to 6, forming and filling. Then he tells Adam, reproduce and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Fill the earth and subdue it. Fill and form. God begins the process of creation. He creates the environment. He provides all the resources and everything else. He sticks man in the garden and says, okay, finish the work. I've been forming and filling, now you're going to form and fill. So tending the garden is this forming a process. It is tending the garden, it is producing art, it's producing the things we need to eat, it's doing the economy, all of that kind of thing. But there's also, note the word protect there. What are we protecting the garden from? I would suggest two things here. The one that a lot of theologians suggest is God knows Satan is waiting in the wings and he's warning Adam at that point. That may be part of it, but I think that there's another important part that we overlook. In the course of developing the resources in the garden and around the garden, Adam also has to protect them. There's an ecological concern built in here. We don't develop the world in such a way that it destroys it. Okay? So that's part of the mandate here, to do the ecological work, or to do our work of developing the garden, tending it, while we also protect it, while we are also concerned about pollution, all of those other kinds of issues here. What it doesn't mean is that we leave the garden as a pristine wilderness. We're to develop it. In other words, we're to cultivate. Remember the yogurt forming, the bacteria forming and filling the yogurt and developing it and turning it into something, well, that in principle is better. I don't know if you like yogurt, but work with me here. that's the kind of thing we're supposed to do. The yogurt bacteria doesn't leave the milk as milk. It changes it into something new, something different. We are to do the same thing, though without destroying what it is we're developing. That's what culture is. That's what Christian culture looks like. It's cultivation. It's cultivation of the arts. It's cultivation of beauty. It's economic development. It's cultivation of relationships. Remember, it's the husband and wife here. And it's doing all of these things, recognizing that, yes, we have dominion in the world, but it is the dominion of a steward, not an owner. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. We may have dominion. We are God's face in the world. But what that means is that we build culture, we develop culture under his authority. And that's got a lot of different aspects. For one thing, like I said, it means that we should not be developing the world in such a way that we abuse it in the process. But it also means that as we have reproduced and multiplied and filled the earth pretty well, it also means that we need to cultivate our relationships with others on the basis of what God has, well, told us, doing it his way. What it means is recognizing the unique dignity and honor that each person is due. It means that just as, well, we love ourselves, which, by the way, Paul defines as no one hates himself, but he feeds himself and takes care of himself and all of those kinds of things, we should treat our neighbors the same way. That's got a lot of implications, too, by the way. You will find Christians who will tell you that, you know, our job is evangelism, our job is bringing people in the kingdom, it's not getting involved in politics or anything like that. Okay. What's the kingdom? Start there. I'm not going to pursue that particular question right now. But let me ask a different one. When a lawyer asks Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? He answers, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Now, this is akin to a true story. Someone once asked Karl Barth, the German theologian, what the greatest what was the most important thing he ever learned in theology? And his reply was, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Jesus' answer, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, was an answer like that, because this is something every Jew knew. They recited it several times a day. The Shema was one of the love the hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. This was a fundamental prayer to all Jews. Everyone knew that. So that answer was no surprise. The stinger was in the second half of it. And the second great commandment is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments, all along the prophets sang. What's really interesting is if you read Romans and Paul talks about the summary of the law, he doesn't say, love God, love your neighbor. He just says, love your neighbor as yourself, because this includes all the commandments. That's the real point. So why am I talking about the commandment to love our neighbor? Well, part of cultivating culture in a world like ours is dealing with issues of politics, dealing with hot button issues like race, dealing with opioid addiction, dealing with all of these kinds of traumas, broken things in the world. So the question is, in this kind of a world, what does it mean to love your neighbor? If we're not to be involved in politics, how do we love our neighbor? If we, as people who have a say in government, as part of a republic, if we don't, well, let's back this up. Do we honestly believe that God loves us and knows what's best for us? I hope you will answer yes. If we believe that, then out of love of neighbor, don't we have to do everything in our power to see that enacted in our society? And doesn't that have implications for what we do in political spheres? It is fundamentally an issue of loving our neighbor, which Paul in Romans says is the summary of the whole law. Building culture also includes the great commandment. It includes loving our neighbor. So culture, as we're working to cultivate ourselves, as we're working to cultivate beauty, as we're working to cultivate business, as we're working to cultivate family, as we're working to cultivate community, as we're working to cultivate society, we need to be doing this as Christians under the authority of God and doing it His way, thinking always first of what it is that God asks of us on behalf of our neighbor, on behalf of the world. And when we take that whole mass of things, there are other areas we could go into too, when we take that whole mass of things, that's what we mean when we're talking about Christian culture. It means that I'm going to switch from yogurt to bread. It means that we are to be leaven in the society. The kingdom of heaven is like a lump of leaven that's hidden in the dough. And somehow this little bit of leaven in the dough causes the whole lump to rise. It doesn't turn the whole lump into leaven. What it does, though, is shape and structure and form the dough into a better, more complete, more perfect thing. And that is what we are to be doing in the world as we think about building culture. It is cultivating what is good. It is cultivating what is beautiful. It is cultivating what is true. And it is cultivating it in every sphere of life. Thank you.